Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number 73. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at a couple of films that aren't too old. They're fairly recent. The first one is from 2014/2015, depending on who you ask. And it's an interesting take on zombie movies called Cooties, which is a lot of fun. It's not to be taken seriously, and it's one of those vulgar pleasures I have. Then I'm going to look at a slightly more serious and interesting movie from the year 2000, and it's M. Night Shyamalan's Unbreakable, starring Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson. So sit back, I'll get the contact deets out of the way, and we'll get going. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, how is everybody doing? The weather here is warmer and warmer each day, so it's all kind of nice there. We had some storms and a potential tornado nearby and a few other bits like that. Tornado fizzled out somewhat, which kind of was a disappointment to everybody who wasn't in the immediate vicinity. But nonetheless, the weather's getting a bit dynamic, and we all kind of like that. The other thing that's happened is we got an Xbox One. Now, I've been running my Xbox 360 and doing some gaming on that. It sucks up immense amounts of time gaming, and that takes away from the movie-related things that I enjoy doing, and of course that I'm obligated to do, including the radio gig. So, Sal actually was the instigator of buying the Xbox One. So, she wanted to play some of the new Tomb Raider games coming out, and she's a big Tomb Raider fan. So, she went and we bought the game, the box, the two Tomb Raider games, one copy of Halo 5, and we got a couple of other games. I think The Witcher 3 and another game thrown in as well. One of the Assassin's Creed ones, one sent in the French Revolution. Problem is this, and I wasn't aware of this beforehand. It takes a shit ton of time for you to download the updates to these games. Now, we've got ADSL and we're running it on Wi-Fi, and it takes crazy amounts of time for the servers to react. Now, we're getting a decent data speed, but the servers just suck in Australia. So we got the box on Friday night, and it's Sunday afternoon now, and we're still trying to update the games we've loaded onto the terabyte of the Xbox One. So fuck you, Microsoft, this is taking way too long. Hopefully it's going to be finished by the time I finish podcasting, so I can get myself some Halo on. But so far, we haven't been able to use the fucking thing. So I'm quite disappointed in that. I'm sure it's a common experience among gamers. This is the first time we've really had a networked console. The 360 doesn't have a Wi-Fi thing on the back of it. So I've just been running it on single player since I got it a while back. But yeah, there's much suckage to do with that. But nonetheless, I'm going to persevere. We will get there, and we'll be playing games on it and having discussions about whose turn it is to use the box. I expect this to diminish the number of movies I get to watch as well. But at the moment, I'm watching movies because I can't. I've got to just wait for this fucking Xbox to update. So that brings me to the next subject, which is the stuff I've been watching. Now, there's an action movie series that's gone seven movies now that I really hadn't watched any of at all. And so I kind of went into a what's all the fuss about binge watch of five of the seven Fast and Furious movies. I watched The Fast and the Furious, the first one, Too Fast, Too Furious, Fast and Furious, these names are monotonously bad, Fast and Furious 6, and Furious 7. The last one directed by James Wan, who's an Australian. And, yeah, it's kind of like Top Gear with lots more accidents and character actors thrown in. It's kind of a combination of car crashes, robberies, which don't have anywhere near the finesse of, say, Rafifi, though there are a couple of good action sequences that are just crazy bug fuck. What the fuck were they thinking? Over the top, ridiculous and ludicrous action scenes. And I can appreciate them at that. That's something that I really like about the thing. So it's a combination of crazy stunts, crazy ideas, character actors, people punching each other, and Vin Diesel talking about family. So I probably won't watch them again. If another one comes out, I may well watch it, because there is a certain kind of Neanderthal charm to the Fast and Furious series. Over the top, people get into car crashes that would at the very least have them in a wheelchair steering it with their tongue in the real world, and what they tend to do is just kind of crick their neck, walk out of it. Maybe they've got a bruise and a small cut over their forehead, but the absurdity of the physics of these movies is really over the top. It kind of does beggar belief. But I watched those and I sort of enjoyed them, yeah, but I can appreciate the fact that you don't need anything approaching intelligence to watch them. And I did see that I kind of cleansed the palate a bit. I kind of went elsewhere and cleansed the palate and watched a 1960 Jean Gabin French film called The Counterfeiters, which is really good. I enjoyed that a lot. Jean Gabin plays a guy called the Old Man, and he is brought in by a bunch of people who used to run a brothel before brothels became illegal in France. So they're living in this great big brothel house, and they've decided what they want to do is counterfeit some Dutch money and make a quick profit by doing that. And so they bring in the Old Man Gabin, who's running a horse farm in South America, because he's retired and got his wealth there, and they bring him in to do it. All of the people involved in this crime are at each other's throats. They're greedy, they're venal, they're nasty for the most part, and they get in a kind of angry young man who's the expert counterfeiter. He's the person who engraves the plates. And he and the Old Man, Gabin, form a relationship. Now, betrayals happen, the cops get involved. It does show you some really nice stuff about how to engrave plates and do all of the stuff you need to do to counterfeit currency in 1960. And it's quite an interesting film. It's in black and white. It's very well made. It's got a great sense of humour and some wry dialogue in it. It's got Martine Carrel playing one of the women in it, and she was one of the great classic beauties of French cinema, along with Daniel Darrieux and a number of other people. But it was kind of fun. I did enjoy the film, and so I watched that. Then I watched the Guy Ritchie remake of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which again is something that was a bit of fun. It's got a slow burn to it. It takes a while to gather pace, and it's got Henry Cavill in it and Armie Hammer, and I don't think either of them's particularly gifted as actors. They're better at playing kind of fashion plates than in acting. But nonetheless, it's got a certain 1960s groovy swing and charm about it, and it wasn't totally a waste of time. And the only other film I've watched is, after watching Cooties, which is one of the films I'm going to talk about this time around, we're doing Cooties and Unbreakable, we decided to watch a cheap sci-fi channel movie called Lovelantula, starring Steve Guttenberg and a number of other people from the Police Academy movies. But it's the usual sci-fi channel absurdist stuff. A whole bunch of volcanoes start erupting around LA and giant lava-spinning spiders come out of it. And a kind of down-and-out ex-action star, played by Steve Guttenberg, has to save the day. Now, these again are vulgar pleasures. You can enjoy them at the level they are. They're silly. You get a few cameos from various people in there. And The special effects are particularly ropey. Their explosions are bad, but you expect them to be bad. The spiders actually are fairly well done, and I kind of like what they do with the spiders. But it's one of those kind of popcorn movies. You watch it because you've been watching some good films for a while, and you want to kind of just veg out. So that was one that Sal and I watched together. And so that was been my week of movie watching. I've gone from car chases to French capers to 60s pastiches to lava spitting spiders. So I pretty much covered the waterfront there. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to do these in reverse chronological order. And the first movie I'm going to talk about is Cooties, a very unusual zombie movie, which has quite a good cast. It's got Elijah Wood in it. Rainn Wilson is in it. Alison Pill, Jack McBrayer, Nassim Pedrad, and a few other kind of groovy people in it.
Sorry, didn't see that.
Well, maybe you should take in your surroundings more.
Yeah.
You are so ugly.
You look like you got chicken pox.
If chicken pox is made out of hemorrhoids,
you listening to me?
What, are you sick or something?
Oh, look! Carnage!
You can't eat the teachers, man!
The others. Please explain to me what's going on.
That girl Shelly has cooties.
He's right.
This is a foodborne virus.
The chicken nuggets. Virus is only dangerous if you haven't gone through puberty.
Are you kidding me?
At 3 o'clock, the parents will come to pick up their kids. We can signal them for help.
Everywhere.
That's Indiana. That's Ohio.
It's an epidemic.
Let's roll.
Remember that suiting up montage in every action film? This is that scene.
Are we ready?
Ready.
Ready. Ready.
I'm gay.
Oh, I knew it.
Time, mother.
Cooties is a 2014/2015 American horror comedy directed by Jonathan Millot and Carrie Mernion. Oh, that was said badly. Mernion. Written by Lee Whannell, who co-wrote the early run of the Saw movies with James Wan. So basically the IMDb says it all. A mysterious virus hits an isolated elementary school, transforming the kids into a feral swarm of savages. An unlikely hero must lead a motley band of teachers on the fight of their lives. So what you have here is fast zombie children who also retain a certain level of intelligence, which is the other part that makes things a lot more difficult. It kind of skews the odds in favor of the kids against the teachers, which is kind of cool. The kids, some of them, well, the kids who don't turn are nice, but the ones who do turn were monsters before they turned, if you know what I mean. In particular, there's one blonde asshole of a kid whose parents cruelly named him Patriot, and who said that when he grows up he's going to become a Marine, who becomes a kind of de facto, to a certain extent, leader of the zombie sprogs. Now, the cast in this I like because they're mostly actors who've gained their renown in comedy, which is probably about right for this kind of a film. The exception, of course, being Elijah Wood, who started out as a child actor and then went on to play hobbits. In fact, there's a scene where Rainn Wilson's character, who's very macho and owns a great big truck and things, his name's Wade, calls Elijah Wood's character Clint a hobbit, which is, it's kind of apt. But the cast are, of course, you've got Elijah Wood playing Clint. He lives at home with his mother. He's a failed writer and a school teacher. He's writing a really bad horror novel, which is kind of like Stephen King's Christine with a boat, which somebody actually points out to him in the course of the movie. He's actually a substitute teacher at a school that he attended when he was a kid. And it's the first Monday of the week. He's substituting and he gets in there and meets all of the other teachers who are all incredibly dysfunctional, each in their own way. There's Wade, who's a PE teacher, played by Rainn Wilson. He's over the top. He has a monster truck. His girlfriend, Lucy, played by Alison Pill, who people might remember from The Newsroom. He's having difficulties with her. She has an attraction to Elijah Wood's character, Clint, which kind of complicates it. So you've got a love triangle built into this movie as well. Then you have the art teacher, Tracy, played by Jack McBrayer, who people might remember from 30 Rock. And you've got a teacher, Doug, played by Australian actor Lee Whannell, who was one of the guys who co-wrote the Saw series. Now, Doug's an interesting character because he's got an acquired brain injury, which gives him a kind of literal approach to things, and he doesn't quite understand human interactions very well. This, of course, helps because he has a focus. He's a science teacher, and he has a focus on trying to find out what's going on with these kids. Then you also have a kind of Christian school teacher, which is interesting because the Christian school teacher, Rebecca, is played by Nassim Pedrad from Saturday Night Live, who's an Iranian-born actor. So she's playing a fundamentalist Christian who's kind of obliquely in her class trying to get the kids to understand that Christianity is the way and that evolution isn't. Then you've also got George Garcia from Lost playing Rick, who's a kind of school janitor handyman kind of character who's spending part of the conflict in his van doing shrooms. And then, of course, you've got all of the kids. Now, this movie, I like for a number of reasons. To do a horror comedy correctly, you've got to be very, very transgressive. And this movie's basic premise is transgressive. There, for many years, there was that trope in American films that you couldn't kill children because that would be one step too far. It's like killing a dog. You don't kill dogs in American movies either because people love dogs. Cats you can kill in some movies, but not dogs or children. In this case, they've got to kill children because the children are trying to kill them. They're not necessarily any stronger than they were as normal children. They're just totally feral, cannibalistic monsters. And there are a lot of them. The teachers are very much outnumbered. But as I said, they retain a certain amount of their intelligence. For instance, they cut the power to the school by cutting off the main circuit boards and things like that. And they have the ability to plan. They just want to... they're still intelligent to the extent that children ever are. And nonetheless, they use that intelligence for their one goal, which is to eat grown-ups. Now, the grown-ups, of course, at first are worried that they're going to get infected in turn, but that doesn't actually happen because as Doug, the science teacher, played quite interestingly and nicely by Lee Whannell, discovers you can't get this virus if you have hit puberty. So it's only prepubescent kids who turn into ravaging, rampaging monsters. There's a nice montage sequence at the start too where we find out where the virus comes from. It's actually from a chicken nugget processing plant, and the first kid gets infected by getting an infected chicken nugget, and they show you the process of making chicken nuggets, which is not a lovely process. They show it from basically chicken to plate in a very good montage. Now, the directors, this is their first feature film, and all strength to them too. I hope they do more of them. But Kerry O'Murnian and Jonathan Miller, have done a lot of commercials in New York, so they do have the cinematography down pat for a feature film. And they do very great job on this one. It's a lot of fun to watch the movie. And the direction is pretty good. There was a little bit of improvisation on set, though the script was quite tight by the time the actors got it. But given the cast they've got there, there was that little bit of improvisation to flesh out the characters a little bit. And it's got a lot of little nods to various bits and pieces. 1980s action films being one of the big tropes there. School, any movie set in a school probably gets a little bit of a nod at some stage in the movie. It's got a it has it from the viewpoint of the teacher, so there's no Breakfast Club-y kind of stuff in there, and the kids are somewhat younger than the kids were in the Breakfast Club. But it does have that kind of admission that of the nastiness of human beings, and there are times when kids misbehave when you want to hit them, but you're not allowed to, and it's exactly the wrong thing to do. But part of the vulgar pleasure of this movie is giving permission for adults to beat the fuck out of children. Now, we've got to be honest about that. It's dark and horrible, and it's a part of the squidgy, ugly side of our souls. But nonetheless, part of the fun of this is seeing Rainn Wilson with a baseball launcher mounted on his shoulder, zapping little children in a darkened hallway with high-speed baseballs. And it's the other part of the fun is now lobbing the heads off things. There's even an extremely funny sequence of one of the kids getting his head bashed in with a fire extinguisher. And in the context of the film, it's perfectly reasonable, it's perfectly funny, but stepped outside of that context, it's a what the fuck kind of moment. And the joy of this film is that kind of transgressiveness. These are no longer children, and that, in fact, Doug does take the brain out of one of the dead kids, the one that gets his head bashed in with a fire extinguisher, in fact, and proves that they're no longer human because there's a lot of brain death going on there. They're just kind of at some level almost mindless monsters, but at another level they've got a certain level of intelligence. But there is that kind of hand waving to justify what's being done to these kids, and that makes it okay in a weird, fucked up cinematic comedy sense. In a real world sense, of course, it's terribly appalling, and I'm sure there are any number of people who, if they saw this film, would be highly offended. But nonetheless, it's a comedy, and of course the name Cooties coming from that kind of mythical germ you get from touching members of the opposite sex when you're an American school kid. But just to kind of round up this one, and I quite liked it. I really enjoyed the movie, mostly because of that transgressiveness. I like the ensemble too. I think all of the actors play off each other really well. I like Alison Pill. She has a meltdown sequence in this movie and plays it really well in character. Very gifted actor. Elijah Wood plays a kind of big-eyed Elijah Wood kind of characters quite well. Rainn Wilson has the right level of absurdity for his character Wade, who can't say dual rear wheel successfully, even though his truck does have dual rear wheels. And it's one of those kind of B comedies. It's very much nothing too serious, but it's a lot of fun. And the horror comedy genre is something that it's very hard to do well. You can do it very badly very easily, but it takes a lot of skill to do it well. The other thing that's doing it well at the moment, I've only seen the first episode of this, is Ash vs. the Evil Dead, the new TV series with Bruce Campbell. And that has the right note too. It does some very transgressive things, but of course, when people are demon-possessed, there's not a lot you can do apart from decapitating them and killing them in various graphic and gore-heavy ways. But, be honest, I like this kind of a comedy. I like this kind of a horror film too. I much prefer this kind than the torture porn kind. I think that more realistic the horror becomes, the more, and this is a purely a personal thing, it does trigger me somewhat. And I see movies to either be educated or entertained. And torture porn doesn't do either of those things for me. I've seen real horror. I've seen people being almost lethally nasty to each other various times in my life, and I don't need to see it as a form of entertainment. It really does piss me off. But Cooties, it's a good, honest horror film. It's a little bit of fun. Like I said, you're not going to put it on the top of your list for the 2015. But it's an honest horror comedy, and it does the job well. And I want to see more from these two directors. They've got a new movie that's in development at the moment called Bushwick, which looks kind of interesting. You might want to look that up and just see the premise of that one. The movie also sets itself up for a sequel, which would be interesting if it had a larger budget. I think it could really work. There's a post-apocalyptic world out there, which would be a lot of fun for them to explore. And I don't usually like sequels, but this is one that probably could work, and there might be a bit of fun in it. But all strength to them. I hope they go really well. The other person I've got to mention that's in this film too is the deputy principal, who doesn't last terribly long. And he's played by a guy called Ian Brennan, who we have to thank, well, if thank is the right word, for the TV series Glee. He developed the concept and basically helmed Glee. Now, I haven't seen Glee, but I have heard some of the singing from Glee. And if Ian Brennan created that mockery of anything reasonable to do with music, then I'm glad he's moved into comedy acting, because I hope he doesn't do that shit again. But that's about it for Cooties. Definitely see it if you're in that kind of comedy horror headspace. It's a bit of fun, and I'm sure it's going to be hitting a lot of things, maybe Netflix, maybe Stan, maybe Presto here in Australia, or whichever platforms you have where you are. But I think it's going to do well on those platforms, and it probably should make a little bit of money on them. So I'm going to take another break. Now when we get back, it's going to be a little more serious with one of the early successes of M. Night Shyamalan, and that is Unbreakable, with Bruce Willis, Robin Wright, and Samuel L. Jackson.
Hi. You're in the emergency room in the Philadelphia City Hospital. I'm gonna ask you some questions. Where were you sitting on the train?
Against the window.
In the passenger car?
Yes.
You're certain you were in the passenger car?
Yeah. Where are the other passengers?
Your train derailed. Took a curve too fast. A second train collided with yours after it derailed. The debris spread over 1 mile.
Why are you looking at me like that?
There are two reasons why I'm looking at you like this. One, because it seems you are the only survivor of this train wreck. And two, you don't have a scratch on you.
I know what's going through your mind right now. You're searching for meaning in all of this. No one thing. 131 people died so you could finally understand the destiny for which you were born. Are you ready for the truth?
Okay, so when is a superhero movie not a superhero movie? This one comes pretty close. It's an interesting take on superheroes, and it's arguably the best movie that Shyamalan made so far. Now, I know that Grant Watson thinks it's his best movie. I haven't seen the Sixth Sense lately, so it's a little hard for me to compare. I saw it when it first came out, and to my credit, and totally fucking the movie for me, I picked the twist in the Sixth Sense pretty early on in the film. It disappointed me, because after that I was kind of looking to see how cleverly they avoided the problem of Bruce Willis's character. I'm not even going to do a spoiler on it. But the, yeah, the, it's, I, I'll go out on a limb. I'll say it's his best movie, and I'll kind of tell you why. The story is quite simple. The movie starts out with the birth of the antagonist in the film, Elijah Price, played by Samuel L. Jackson. They show his birth. His mother drops the baby in a ladies' room in a department store in 1961. And a doctor's brought in, a black doctor, is brought in to check the baby over. She's already had the baby by herself in this ladies' room. And the problem the doctor finds is he asks the people around if they dropped the baby, because the baby was born with a number of broken limbs, and has found out that Elijah Price has type 1 osteogenesis imperfecta, which means he has brittle bones, essentially. Then we later see him as the movie progresses as a teenager, and how his mother encourages him to go out of the house even though there is that risk of him breaking bones. And we see him as quite a successful seller of art, and specializing in comic book art. And, you know, we see the progress through the entire lifetime of this character, who is an extraordinary person. He's overcome a disability. He's very intelligent. He's become an expert in his field. And yet he has an essential flaw, and the pain of the way children treated him as a child has affected him profoundly. Then we have the other character, the protagonist of the film, David Dunn. We first see him on a train going from New York to Philadelphia. He's, you know, kind of melancholy guy. He's Bruce Willis without a wig, so he's kind of bald Bruce Willis, which is perfect for the role. And he kind of has a half-hearted attempt to chat up an attractive woman on the train, who rebuffs him, and he kind of regrets it. And you can see that he was only half meaning to. He just, you know, didn't have the chops to do it successfully. And then we cut to the train traveling very fast, and everyone's starting to get scared. And then there's a cut suddenly. And then we see the aftermath of this, which is in the trailer there. We see the doctor asking Bruce Willis's character, David Dunn. Again, you've got the alliteration on the two names, the way superheroes have. And asking him basically how he survived it when 131 other people didn't in the train accident. He's gone out there without a scratch. And there's a beautiful shot. That shot is one of the best in Knight's film. I can't say Shyamalan correctly, so I'm going to call him Knight from now on. It's one of the best shots in his whole film career, because you've got in the middle background Bruce Willis and the doctor, and Bruce Willis is facing the camera sitting on a hospital gurney. And in the foreground, out of focus, you've got the other survivor of the accident, whom the doctors are working on. He doesn't survive. And all you see is a blanket-covered body and the people around. They've layered the sound so that you can hear Bruce Willis and the doctor talking, but you can also hear these people doing emergency procedures on this profoundly mangled person. And as Bruce Willis and the doctor continue, there's a slow zoom in. And as it zooms in, blood starts soaking through the blankets they've got covering this man. It's a very, very effective shot. Very simple shot, but a very effective one. And then we see David Dunn leaving the hospital, where everybody, the families of the other people in the crash are sitting in the waiting room, and he kind of walks out numb, and his family, his wife and his young son, Joseph, played by an actor called Spencer Tree Clark. His wife is played by Robin Wright. They meet him and escort him out of the building. We then see some scenes with the family, and there's obviously an estrangement between Audrey, the wife, and David Dunn. She's sleeping in another room of the house. They don't communicate very much. David is a very distant man. He's kept a distance between himself, his wife Audrey, and his son Joseph, almost as a deliberate ploy, and he doesn't know why. This shows the career arcs, too. This movie shows the career arcs of two of the people involved in the making of the film, Bruce Willis and Knight himself. Bruce Willis has great skill as an actor when he chooses to. He's one of those actors who, if you see him in a few of the character roles, like this one, Sixth Sense, in Country, he did in the 1980s, he's profoundly good in that, and in another number of other roles. This guy's got the chops to show a tough but sensitive man, and to do it very well. And this movie is probably one of his best acting roles, from the simple viewpoint of he's showing somebody who's traumatized by something he doesn't quite know what is. Plus, he's got the trauma of having survived the car, train crash, and he's kind of, you know, got a touch of PTSD because of that. And there's an arc there for the character showing how he finds out who he is and how he finds and accepts his best self. But for Bruce Willis, his later career has really kind of been on a downer. His cash checks, basically, there are movies he did for the money that weren't very good, and that's, of course, tarnished his brand in Hollywood. And he's been cranky in interviews and all that kind of thing. So, in a sense, Bruce Willis and David Dunn, the character, are paralleled in a way. He's not doing his best work, and he either doesn't give a shit or knows that he can do better than he does. And that, again, is the David Dunn character as well. Then we have the career of M. Night Shyamalan, and his career is a kind of as profound a drop off a cliff as Bruce Willis's is. He overused the gimmicks, basically. One of the things, it's sometimes interesting to try to figure out where his head's at with these films, things like The Happening and Signs and all those movies. He assumes we haven't seen the same movies and TV shows that he saw as a kid, and yet we have. So the twists became, over the arc of his career and over the movies he's made, more obvious. The premises became more absurd, and we kind of, you know, his name became a punchline for a certain kind of Twilight Zone-ish twist-ending movie making, which worked well for this movie and to an extent for The Sixth Sense, but I think more in this film, Unbreakable, than in The Sixth Sense. But after that, we came to kind of go, okay, where's the twist? And there's the problem. Lady in the Water I haven't seen, but I hear is a piece of shit. Yeah, he's tried to redeem himself. The last couple of things he did, there was a movie called Devil, which was kind of cool because he drew back on the budget and did a fairly low budget. Cost $10 million to make and made $63 million, so that wasn't too bad. Then he went on to do that stupid After Earth vanity project for Will Smith and his son, which I saw and which is ridiculous. Even though it didn't make a lot of money, it cost $130 million to make, and it ended up breaking in $244 million. Then he did Wayward Pines miniseries for FX Productions, and a small-budget horror film, The Visit, which has actually done pretty well. It cost $5 million to make, and it made $90 million in the box office. So it's not... It's, you know, he may be making a comeback and trying to do things a little differently, but he's still got that addiction to the twist, and I think that may be affecting his filmmaking in a negative way. We kind of, you know, a lot of people think of him as a one-trick pony, but I think that if he can just shake, you know, maybe do two or three films that don't have, you know, 180 degree or 360 degree or pretzel twist in them, then maybe he could start getting that credibility back. Now, there are a few people who've accused him of plagiarism as well. There was a Pennsylvania screenwriter called Robert McKinney who said that there were similarities between Signs and his unpublished manuscript. And Margaret Peterson Haddix noted that The Village had a lot of similarities to a young adult novel she'd made called Running Out of Time. So, you know, with those kind of problems, his career is kind of on a knife edge at the moment. It can either go the redemption path, which everybody likes a good redemption story, or it can end up doing more TV and less of the big budget cinema stuff, and with the interesting actors who've got names like Bruce Willis, of course, and Samuel L. Jackson. But the interesting thing about this film is that kind of duality between Elijah, and Samuel L. Jackson is very good at it. Even though physically he's wrong for somebody with osteogenesis imperfecta, he puts it across very well, and he's got some really nice little tropes about him. He wears purple a lot, and that's the dominant colour of the character. At one stage, before he has an accident on a staircase, he has a glass walking stick, which is a really nice little thing that Samuel L. Jackson came up with. And he's got kind of big... One of the nice things in Samuel L. Jackson's career is watching his hair. The fake hair he puts on is always interesting. He hasn't gone with a normal hairstyle in a movie for the last 20 years. And this one's based on the historical figure of Frederick Douglass. So he's got a Frederick Douglass hairstyle in this. And he, you know, the costuming gives you an impression of somebody who's lean and fragile, even though we see Samuel L. Jackson as a big, robust kind of guy. And he's plays it really well. The guy who plays him, his character as a teenager, though, isn't as good. That's a young actor who only did two things, really. The movie and an episode of Third Watch, a guy called Johnny Hiram Jamison. And he's maybe the weak spot in this film. He's really not that good. But he wasn't necessarily a professional actor and really didn't have his heart in it. But the arc of the characters is interesting. And they meet because Elijah leaves an invitation on the windshield of David Dunn's car. And invites him to his gallery, which is called, he said, looking it up, because it's here somewhere. Blah, 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 blah. It's called Limited Edition Rare Art, where he collects original comic book art in an art gallery setting. And there's a good scene with a potential client of the gallery where we see little hints of Elijah's true nature coming through, which is kind of cool, and it's a really well-written scene. My tongue's going because it's getting later in the evening now. And, and Samuel L. Jackson puts it across with that kind of escalating voice that he uses, where he starts fairly low and slow and escalates and gets faster until he's eventually flogging the person he's talking to as if with a whip. But in essence, underneath this, it is a superhero tale and a comic book superhero tale, because Elijah's belief systems are informed predominantly by old-school American comic books. And the movie tries to address some of the issues you have with comic books and comic book superheroes as well. Like, how do superheroes find out when a crime is going on or find the criminals? The movie addresses that with one of the powers that David Dunn manifests in the movie. And it is quite striking when he does find out about a particularly nasty crime and rescues two children from a house where an invader has killed the parents and is holding the children hostage. That's a beautifully done, prolonged scene. And it works really well, because the difficulty of doing a scene like that where you kind of, somebody's come into a house and has killed the parents and has the children tied up in a bathroom, there are ways that can become really icky in a sense and really kind of prurient. But the movie avoids that really well by focusing on the apprehension and the fear and the kind of slow progress that David Dunn makes going through the house. He's wearing a green hooded raincoat in that scene, and he does have that kind of superhero thing. People have said he looks a little bit like the Spectre out of DC Comics, but I don't get that. I mean, I think that the hood represents a cape and a cowl more than it represents a specific superhero. And that scene is nuanced and plays really subtly, giving us enough of the horror to realize that this is a serious thing and the potential is there for David Dunn to lose his life because he's up against somebody who is totally without mercy and is totally ruthless. So there's enough of the detail there for that, but there's also They don't go into the prurient areas, which is a really nice and a fine judgment call to make. It's a very much a balancing act to get that just right. And I think the movie does do that. And, yeah, that's subsequent, as I said, to addressing the problem of how does a superhero find out about crime. And the movie addresses it in an interesting, not entirely novel, but an interesting and kind of subtle way, which I liked. I can really run with that. I do appreciate that. And it does let us know, as the film progresses, exactly what the superpowers are of David Dunn. We learn about them just as he does. We learn about the super strength and the strength he has. The train crash tells us that he's, if not indestructible, then quite impervious to a lot of injury. He's never been sick a day in his life, except in one case when he got pneumonia from almost drowning in a swimming pool. And then that brings us to one of the other tropes of superhero comics, which of course is every superhero needs to have a vulnerability. And in David Dunn's case, it's water. And even though there's a bit at the front of the movie where they tell us a little bit about the history of comic books and how much they're a part of our culture and things like that, the movie does develop not as a superhero origin story necessarily, but as a character piece. It's about a man who is withdrawn from his family and is very much on the edge of losing his marriage to a woman he does love, but is kind of reluctant to share his emotions with, because he's kind of in almost a larval state. He hasn't got his wings yet. He hasn't found out who he is and what he needs to do with his life, even though he is late 30s, maybe early 40s. There's a kind of lost feeling to the character. And again, there's that estrangement between him and his wife, Audrey. And Robin Wright plays that really well, even though it's very much a supporting role. It is written well enough. One of the problems we have in a lot of these movies is that women's roles tend to be underwritten. This one definitely isn't. There is a meeting between Elijah and Audrey, which goes in an interesting way as well. And we see her. She's a physical therapist as by profession, while David is a security guard. And Robin Wright, profoundly good actor, really didn't get some of the chops that she should have. We know her from all sorts of things like The Princess Bride and all those kind of things. But and, of course, Forrest Gump. But, yeah, in this one, she does play the character dead straight down the line, realistic. And all of the acting, except for perhaps Samuel L. Jackson, is realistic. And of the two, I think Bruce Willis has the harder role in playing that kind of locked-in character, but playing it in a way that's not unsympathetic and is, you know, keeps us on his side in a sense, even though the villain of the piece, Elijah Price, a.k.a. Mr. Glass, is the much more intriguing character. He's got the more interesting arc in a flamboyant way, whereas David Dunn has an interesting arc in a subtle way, and in a way that, in a sense, reflects the journey that most men go on. That kind of, what is it to be a man? Can I relax enough to make the people I love aware of my feelings? Can I share them? Can I impose that burden of my feelings on the people I love? All of that stuff is stuff that guys can relate to very much. And I think Bruce Willis puts that across really well. Whereas the Elijah Price character has turned the adversity in his life and the bullying he went through and the pain he went through into something much darker. He's adopted a role from comic books and shaped the world around him for that role until he found the person he knew had to exist, who was the exact opposite of himself. And that's kind of interesting. The realism plays off against the mythic archetypes of the comic book in a really great way. That's been done worse in other films. And one of the things I like about this film, and that I really appreciate in what Knight has done with it, is it's a superhero movie with no special effects. There is not a special effect in there, really. There's no CGI stuff. There's no obvious, tricky manifestations of the heroes abilities. Yeah, there is in bench pressing immense amounts of weight, but yeah, you know, we can accept that. We know that's some kind of trickery, but it's in-camera trickery. And we can see he is kind of impervious to a lot of harm, which again is something that any protagonist in an action film has. But in the framework of this being a superhero movie, takes on a special significance. It takes on a lot more power than it does if we see Vin Diesel in a Fast and Furious movie drive a car down a mountain and then shrug it off. That's one thing. But where David Dunn is fighting the man in orange who has kidnapped these two kids and is being bashed around the wall and he's getting elbows in the ribs and elbows in the gut, for us, that's a much more powerful kind of act of violence than the cartoony stuff you get in those other movies. This is, in a sense, an action film, but it's also a character piece, and the character stuff really lifts the action and the comic book tropes to a height that they don't normally attain. And that's one of the reasons why it's such a good film. The script is written well. The characters, whether it be the hero or the antagonist, whether it's Joseph, the son, who is going through his own arc and discovers things about his father which almost cause him to take an irrevocably bad act, whether it's Audrey and her trying to get back with her husband, and the little date night they have in a very long shot one scene, which is really nicely done. And, of course, David Dunn's own arc and him becoming comfortable with his own nature. I mean, this is a thinking person's superhero movie in a lot of ways. And as much as I love things like the Marvel Cinematic Universe and even some of the DC stuff I really have a fondness for, this is at a different level. This is character first, character creating the world, rather than the world creating the character. And that's really something that I wouldn't say I want to see other people emulate, because this movie, if you start emulating it, you're going to be copying it in a sense. But I think there's a pathway or a very loose template there that some superhero movies could take on board were they not locked into their own paths. And one of the strengths and weaknesses of something like the Marvel Cinematic Universe is that there's a lot of front loading of material for the next movies in the mosaic that is the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and they don't have the time and the space to do the slow, logical character and world building that a movie like Unbreakable does. And yeah, that's okay, because there's room in the world for both kinds of movies. But this one is something special, and it shows a couple of things. First one is that, you know, these kind of stories can be told in a grown-up way. And the other thing is that regardless of their current travails, Bruce Willis and M. Night Shyamalan are very good at what they do in certain circumstances, at certain times. And to see them do lesser work is disappointing. I mean, movie making at that level is a world of politics. So there's kind of all sorts of stuff that isn't to do with the creative process that comes involved with it. There are the accountants and the money makers, and is this guy going to be profitable for us? They get involved in the casting. They get involved with messing with the scripts as well. There are so many fingers in the pie that it's hard to see what the pie's shape should be with a Hollywood film. And that could be one of the problems with the careers of Bruce Willis and M. Night Shyamalan. Who knows? But I've got enough fondness for them, and I think they built up enough goodwill with me as a movie watcher that I want to see good things from them. I mean, it's, they owe me nothing. I'm just a guy paying to see a movie. They don't really owe me that much, but I've got that fondness for what they've done in the past to want them to do better than they do at the moment. You can make a list of people that are in that kind of situation with any number of moviegoers. But I think that one of the lovely things about cinema is if it's done well, and if we don't need to be patted on the head. We don't need to be spoon-fed things. We don't need the squee of a Star Wars trailer to have a fondness for actors and fondness for characters and a fondness for movie makers in general. They do build up goodwill with us, and it is disappointing when it can be perceived that that goodwill is being squandered. So there's not much else to say there about Unbreakable. I really enjoyed revisiting it. I sat down and watched it with Sal, and we both enjoyed it again. We knew all the beats, we knew all the tropes, we knew all the twists, but seeing them put together and seeing the construction of them and seeing the little subtleties of acting by the ensemble really made it a worthwhile experience for us. But anyway, I'm going to finish up there and finish up the podcast as well. I'll be back in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast, in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. Who knows what they will be? I want to send a shout-out to Travis Johnson, who's currently in hospital. Be well, and also I'll do a shout out to his Patreon campaign. If you type in celluloid and whiskey, you can find Travis's film writings and his Patreon campaign. So chuck him a couple of bucks a month. I do, for his stuff. And get well. So anyway, I'm going to finish it up there. As I said, two different kinds of movies: Cooties, Vulgar Pleasure; Unbreakable, a subtle and interesting character piece, which also happens to be a superhero origin story. There were talk of some sequels after this, which various of the people involved were up for, but they just never came together up to this time. But anyway, I'm going to finish up there. Look after yourselves. Be kind to each other. Watch good films. Watch bad films. Just watch films. And I'm going to be back in a week and in 2 weeks. And of course, as always, I'll leave you with my own Patreon. Let me start that again. My own Patreon patron tribute in the form of movie credits. So take care of yourselves. I'll be back very soon. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris our Camera Operator, Christopher our Gaffer, Miss Jane our Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy the Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark our Second Unit Director, Paul, our Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy, the Donut Wrangler, Tim, the New York Unit Director, and Rabbi Steve, our Spiritual Advisor. We also have Paul, who does the Special Makeup Effects, and Kathleen, who has yet to have a job in the credits. And Eric, of course, is the Set Security Lead. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.